Chop Talk is brought to you by the Kosho School of Karate's premium martial arts training equipment. Frustrated with the low quality of the big manufacturers, the hassle and expense of custom-made equipment, or the months-long delivery times offered by the Japanese brands, if your order ever arrives at all? Kosho offers makiwara, iron sandals, specialty punching bags, and other premium martial arts training equipment, all at great prices and great delivery times. Kosho equipment is guaranteed to be high quality and heavy duty, exactly what serious traditional martial artists demand. Contact the Kosho School of Karate for more information. Go to www.koshoequip.com or email koshoschoolofkarate@gmail.com. Kosho, premium martial arts training equipment for the serious martial artist. Hey everybody, welcome to Chop Talk. I'm your host, Nate England. Wherever you listen to the show, please write a review and give us a 5-star rating. Be sure to check out photos and links from this week's show on the Chop Talk Facebook page, and get updates on shows, karate news, and training tips by following us on Twitter. Our guest today is Louis Martin, author of The True Believers. Louis' book explores the fanaticism and cultism that is common in the martial arts through his own experiences training in Seibukan Jiu-Jitsu. The book and Louis' experiences are similar to Leah Remini's exploration of Scientology in her A&E show Scientology in the Aftermath. But the martial arts world has its own version of this cultism, and it's not always easy to draw the line between normal martial arts stuff, which, let's be honest, can get a little weird sometimes, and taking it to this bizarre, amplified version of reality. As Louis gets into his experiences, you begin to see where it is possible for instructors to take advantage of people, financially, emotionally, while the students themselves have culpability by deifying their instructors, and this continued one-upsmanship for his attention. Louis' book is a very honest exploration of his experiences in martial arts, and it's not really like any other martial arts book I've come across. I think anybody who's trained in the martial arts is going to relate to some of the things that Louis saw and was involved in, even if it's not to the same degree. And it's also a good warning for people looking to get into martial arts of some of the things to watch out for. And also for martial arts school owners and instructors, just to make sure that they keep themselves in check so that things don't get out of control. You can find the book, The True Believers by Louis Martin, on Amazon. And I'll put a link in the show notes and on Facebook. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. This week's guest is Louis Martin, who is the author of The True Believers. Louis, how you doing?
Every day's a holiday. Thanks for communicating with me and having me on the show, Nate.
Well, hey, thanks for reaching out. And I read the book and I really enjoyed it. It's a really compelling read. I don't want to give too much away here. We'll get into some of it during the conversation today, but it basically starts with your introduction to martial arts, and then it sort of snowballs and starts building and building, and it gets a little weirder and weirder as it goes on. And I gotta tell you, man, you were into some weird shit.
Well, it feels oddly gratifying to hear you say that, Nate, because for, you know, a couple reasons. One is that the first wave of readers of this book, and it came out fairly recently, was people that were there. They were involved in the story. Mm-hmm. And to them, it was just, they were there. It wasn't weird to them. It was just what it was. And it takes a while to step back and look at it from the third person and objectively be like, yeah, that was something else. That was kind of out there. But for me, when I hear someone like you, who wasn't involved in it at all, look at it and be like, holy shit, it kind of reaffirms me and be like, okay, it wasn't just me. Like, this was not normal, this path in martial arts. But in a weird way, it kind of is normal. That's mm-hmm. That's why the book needed to get written, I think. Yeah. It's a story about, you know, fanaticism and fantasy and delusion in martial arts. And it's just told through my personal experience, but I think it's something a lot of people can read and relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think what a lot of people, and the particular school that you were in really sort of preferred people who had never been in the martial arts before. And no matter where you start, you think that whatever martial art you're doing and however you start it, well, that's how everybody does it. That's the way that it is. And it's not till later, till you start maybe spreading your wings a little bit, you know, going to a seminar here, meeting a friend who does something else over there, that you start to find out, well, maybe this one thing that we're doing, you know, is a little bit out of the ordinary. And that could be out of the ordinary good. Like, you don't realize how good you have it. Man, I got this teacher and he's really knowledgeable and I had no idea. Or it could be really, you know, really out of the ordinary bad, where it starts getting into some bizarre mysticism and you're going to learn how to levitate or something, you know, something that's just not reality. But as a beginner, you don't really know.
Yeah, that's, I think, the big disadvantage of when you're brand new and you're shopping for a martial arts school. Mm-hmm. And I talked about this with me in the book, is that you really don't know what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And this was certainly not pre-internet. This was 2006, but
right.
You know, I didn't do a lot of that research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I walked into school and I saw that virtually everyone in the dojo I went into was a black belt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was like for every one color belt, there was 10 or 15 black belts.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, that didn't quite jive with what I had seen or heard about in martial arts.
Right.
And I asked a guy, well, why is there so many black belts? And he just simply said, well, we have a lot of different levels of black belts. And mm-hmm. I was like, good enough for me. That
right.
sounds right. I guess, you know, I'm not in a position to question what he was saying. And that's kind of the narrative throughout a lot of my martial arts journey, is I just didn't know until I started kind of cross-training a little bit and telling people about my experiences and getting some of those odd looks about, oh, you guys do that? Oh, that's a little weird.
Right, right. So can you talk about, you know, how you got into this particular school and some of the early training, just sort of the beginning, so everyone can understand, you know, how you started, which I think the way you started is a pretty typical story. You were interested in what, self-defense, and you found this school, and then it kind of went from there.
Yeah, so I got into martial arts in a really unremarkable way. I had a friend that was training, and he was doing jiu-jitsu, but he was doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And at the time, I didn't really understand the difference. And he said, well, you should check out Hoist Gracie, which is how most people find out about jiu-jitsu nowadays. And they
right.
watch those early UFCs and they say, wow, this is the real deal. And this is what I'm going to do.
Right.
And that's what happened to me. But I walked into, by chance, a Japanese jiu-jitsu dojo.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that they weren't doing what Hoist was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But what they were doing looked cooler than what Hoist was doing.
Yeah.
Because one thing about Brazilian jiu-jitsu is, to the uninitiated, it doesn't look super sexy a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's, you know, it's guys wrestling around and a lot of like kind of grinding, smothering action. You can't really appreciate the movements and the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
But Japanese jiu-jitsu, it's a little bit more understandable, and especially at my school where we had a heavy Aikido influence, I mean, it was aesthetically a beautiful martial art.
Yeah.
And again, to my untrained eye, I sort of went with, you know, you go with the car that looks better if you don't know about cars, and
sure.
you might not choose the car that's driving best, but
yeah,
that
one looks fast. It's got a spoiler and it's red, and
100%.
I want it. Yeah. And you know, So jiu-jitsu, both Brazilian kind and the Japanese kind, they're a little bit out of my wheelhouse. I'm not as familiar with those as I am with some other martial arts. But, you know, basically my understanding of the beginning was Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you know, at that time there were these challenges matches going on in Brazil, and the Gracies had learned from a Japanese judo master. And but in these challenge matches, it wound up being much more ground fighting, and they were very long, 20, 30 minutes or even longer. And they were all, you know, it was trying to pin or lock or smother the other guy. And this is pre to UFC, so we're talking about as this thing developed. Am I in the ballpark with my understanding of the history?
Yeah, 100%. Brazilian jiu-jitsu, calling it jiu-jitsu could be considered kind of a misnomer. It really descended from judo.
Right.
But in the, in the 1920s when the Brazilians, mainly the Gracies, were first learning jiu-jitsu, they were learning from a guy that did judo, but judo had begun to get a little bit of a reputation as being like a clean, sanitized martial art.
Mm-hmm.
So some people that had been doing more progressive things in judo, they said, well, we're calling what we do jiu-jitsu because it's a little bit less formal. We don't follow as many rule sets as judo had begun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy like Maeda Sensei, when he came to Brazil, he told people he was doing jiu-jitsu, but essentially what he was doing was much closer to judo.
Yep.
You know, the real Japanese roots jiu-jitsu that like Takeda Sensei practiced in Daito Ryu jiu-jitsu. It was real, you know, hardcore samurai shit. It was a lot of weapon work, you know, really, really formal. And, you know, it had kata still. And that's kind of what Seibukan Jiu-Jitsu, the martial art that I did and that the book's about, was. We had a lot more weapon work. We had a lot of sword work. We did have some kata. And we did, you know, a lot of hands-on training, a lot of wrist locks, joint locks, chokes, leg locks. I mean, it was a very diverse system.
Mm-hmm.
But as opposed to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, we did not do sparring. We did very little resistance training.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the things about BJJ is it takes place in the context of a one-on-one match or fight of some sort, because that's
right.
What judo is.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Japanese is, it's kind of coming from this battlefield mindset.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a pretty wide, from my limited understanding, there's a pretty wide variety of types of Japanese jiu-jitsu. The Japanese jiu-jitsu was more the unarmed martial art of the samurai. So there were types that looked like, you know, Aikido with a lot of these throws, and very almost acrobatic throws. There were some that were more, you know, based on joint locks. From my understanding, there was even types of jiu-jitsu that looked very much like karate that emphasized, you know, punches and kicks and elbow smashes. So there's a very wide variety, from my understanding. Now, this is the Seibukan that you were working. What did that grow out of? Now, it was started by, I think the head instructor was from Puerto Rico originally. And he was the founder of this style, but it came from a few different Japanese arts.
Yeah, so the crash course in it is, the founder's name is Julio Toribio. And his sort of title that we called him in Seibukan, and I still kind of call him to this day just because it's what I think of him as in
sure.
my head,
sure.
Is Kancho. And Kancho is sort of an informal way to refer to like the head of a household in Japan.
Mm.
Ironically, it's also a game where you shove your thumb up someone's ass, apparently. So if you Google Kancho, you might find different things.
Yeah, oh man, I'm not going to Google that then.
That's a real thing. So that's an aside. And Julio, he had a really wide array of experiences in martial arts in the 70s and 80s. He started off doing karate. I think it was like a form of Okinawan Kenpo karate.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a Dan ranking in that, a black belt. And then he did a form of ninjutsu called Bujinkan. And Bujinkan was obviously really popular in the 80s, as all ninjutsu stuff was. And it still exists today. So he did that, got really high ranked in that. And he got to a Shihan level in Aikido. And then he basically got to the very top of a jujitsu system. And then there was some sort of scandal. He got kicked out.
Mm.
And I don't really know what happened. I've heard his version of the story.
Right.
And his version is probably the correct version, which is he was cross-training a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, in some circles, the Japanese don't like that.
Yeah.
And I think, and you know a lot about this, I'm sure, Nate, because you've done Japanese karate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Japanese martial arts, they're linked closely with a family. And, you know, if you want to really get to the high levels of a Japanese martial art, it's kind of like you're joining a family. Cross training, it's really taken as, you know, it can be taken as an affront by some
yeah.
of the Japanese.
Yeah.
Very different than American martial arts, where we sort of have no loyalty and we're just loyal to what works. So Julio was cross-training. They asked him to leave, and he said, well, shit, I've have this tremendous background in all these martial arts. I'm going to throw it all together and make my own thing. Right. And that's a pretty common thing. That's kind of how all martial arts get started. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Seibukan was a really good, you know, pretty balanced mix of all the traditional Japanese martial arts. Like I said, it had a pretty heavy Aikido influence. Mm-hmm. And as a martial art, I mean, I really enjoyed the way it was structured and organized. And, you know, it wasn't I'm probably going to trash it for the next hour, but I should say right now, you know, there were some really great things about it, and there had to be to keep me involved for 7 years and so many other people.
Looking for a way to gain an edge on the competition? Want to give your body some much-needed relief and relaxation? Try Medical Resort ATAC, Okinawa's specialists in sports therapy and wellness care. ATAC offers customizable massage therapy. Try their oxygen chamber to increase metabolism, reduce fatigue, and promote faster recovery from injuries. Take their stretching course to increase flexibility and release muscle fatigue. ATAC also offers special courses in static and thermal therapy, foot therapy, and head therapy. Or try a session of ATAC's latest offering, acupuncture therapy, with their fully licensed acupuncture therapist. Want to find out more? ATAC is open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Stop into their center located at 12830 Oroku in Naha City, Okinawa. Call 098-859-1890 or visit them on the web at www.a-tac.net. That's www.a-tac.net. Staff is fluent in English, Portuguese, Spanish, and Japanese. Going back just a couple 30 seconds ago, you're talking about the cross training, and you know, I've seen that from a couple of different angles. You know, on the one hand, in Okinawa, it's very typical for people to have one karate teacher and another kabuto teacher, weapons teacher, and you might be doing, you know, and you're learning completely separate from these two different people. But going to different karate schools is very often frowned on. I got away with it for a couple of reasons. I mean, I got called on it once. The thing about Okinawa is it's super small. So everybody knows everybody, and they know you whether you know it or not. So I went to this end-of-the-year party, and the guy who was at the head of the table goes, "You... Nato," and I'm like, "Yes, sir." And he's like, "You train Miyahira Dojo." I'm like, "Oh, yes, sir." "You also train Shinzato Dojo." I'm like, "Oh, yes, sir." "Why?" "Well, sir, I came here and I started studying with Shinzato Sensei, and Shinzato Sensei introduced me to Miyahira's dojo and said I should train there too. So I've been training in both." And he sits back and goes, "Ah, yes. This very good. You always must continue training with this first teacher." And it was okay. And everybody knew about it, and it was okay. But there were other people that got in trouble. I had a friend who came over and was going to be training with a group that's a very large international group. And he paid quite a bit of money for the training, and he paid quite a bit of money to literally live in the dojo. It was not luxurious. It was a small Okinawan dojo, and he kind of got taken advantage of a little bit, and he worked out with another guy that was in the same, it was in the same organization, and the teacher found out and tossed him out on his butt. So there's a range. I think it's possible to cross train in Japan, because I did it. But you know, there's definitely limits. Now, even in the U.S., though, if you are involved in a martial art, you know, there's a lot of times where even then cross training can be frowned on to one extent or another.
The X factor there is your rank, because if you are, and I've even experienced this in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I just moved to a different part of California, so I'm checking out new schools. And, you know, it's way easier to cross-train when you're a white belt or, you know, somewhere thereabouts, because you haven't really ascended the ranks in the organization. Everyone's sort of glad to happen or glad to have you. Mm-hmm. But once you start getting to, I think, that like brown black belt level, you know, by then you're kind of tied in with your school. And then, you know, you go to another school. If you are a brown or a black belt, you know, you're inherently going to be a little bit more threatening to some of the people and the students there, mm-hmm. because, you know, they're not going to just be able to just show you how they do things. You're going to have your own way, and you could be, in their minds, better than them. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, you can get away with that for quite a while, but eventually it starts to feel like you're a little bit locked in. And that can be, you know, a little problem. Sometimes when I cross trained in Japanese martial arts, I would just wear a white belt to every other, you know, dojo I went to. But that's kind of harder to get away with in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You kind of need to keep your belt on.
Right. Yeah, you know, typically whenever I'm on the road or whenever I'm traveling internationally, you know, I'll take my black belt and my white belt. And if I go into a dojo, I'll bring them both out and say, hey, which one do you want me to wear?
And, yeah, that's smart.
And sometimes they go, black belt's fine, no big deal. Other times they say, you white belt. And I said, okay, and that's fine too. And it just depends. Now, I would say that I might flip it on you and say that it's more difficult to cross-train as you're a beginner. Because, you know, I'll get people that come in as, like, they're white belt, they're just beginning karate, but... And I'm trying to teach them the basics. Now, if they're going to a Taekwondo school or Kung Fu school down the street, somebody else is trying to teach them just the basics. And and they're both going to be – maybe both of them have good high blocks, but maybe they're done just a little bit different. And if you're a beginner, you're just going to get confused and overwhelmed, and neither of them are going to be good. So, you know, I might push back a little bit and say – if you start something, get serious with it, you know, focus on that, and then maybe branch out a little bit later. But
yeah, I can see your point. I also think, you know, cross training in Japanese martial arts is kind of its own monster, its own beast that you have to learn to deal with in a technical sense, but also just in a sense of, you know, diplomacy and you know, there's a right way to do it. You gotta call ahead. You gotta be really deferential to the instructor. You can't go in there and be challenging them and you know, you gotta ask, like you said, you know, what belt do you want me to wear? In Seibukan, the way we sort of handled that was we talked about this in the beginning, that a lot of what was happening in Seibukan was not normal, and we weren't aware of that. And why not? Because we really didn't cross train. Mm-hmm. But we thought that we did, which was that Kancho had, obviously he was the head of Seibukan,
right?
But he was also a black belt in Bujinkan and a black belt in Aikido and a black belt in the Japanese sword. Mm. And karate too, but he didn't teach karate for one reason or another. So Kancho would tell everyone, oh, cross training is so important. You absolutely should cross train. That's the secret to success. And we're like, oh, great. Mm-hmm. And Kancho would say, and the person you should cross train is
me.
You should cross train under me. Yeah.
Right.
So what we would do is, you know, Seibukan class would end and we would take a 10-minute break and we'd all change uniforms and we'd go back on the same mat and we'd do a slightly different bow. And it's like, oh, we're cross training now.
Yeah.
But really, we weren't getting exposed to other schools which have other customs, other instructors, other ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. So it was a way for us to think that we were expanding our horizons, but really we were staying in the same bubble.
The guy has, you know, a legitimate martial arts resume, right? I mean, he had black belts and all these things. So, you know, so he knew about it, but it was still you're still very isolated. Because you only got his point of view, and it was from in this style, the system that he created. Mm-hmm. Have you compared what you were doing there to other Japanese jiu-jitsu systems to see, you know, how in line was he with some of these other things, or how, you know, how far did he diverge with the system that he created?
I have. I was fortunate enough that during that time, I traveled a lot for work. I was a recruiter, so I would drive up and down the state I recruited for a university, and I stopped at a lot of other schools, and the ones that I would always look for was Japanese jiu-jitsu or aikido or judo sometimes. So I did go to other Japanese jiu-jitsu schools. On a technical sense, they were pretty similar, but they didn't have the aikido influence. So a lot of technically the Japanese jiu-jitsu, it was much more kind of stationary. And there wasn't the feeling of like blending and, you know, a lot of movement with your attacker. But other than that, I mean, they were really similar. Like I could jump in there and I would fit right in. I could jump into a Hapkido school. I would fit right in. What was different was that and again, you know a lot about this, Nate, I believe, is, you know, the Japanese style of instruction and teaching in classes is what's the word? It's a little stoic, huh?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
Yeah. So in a lot of the other schools I went to, you know, it was generally a quiet dojo. It was kind of like speak when spoken to. You know, people were still friendly and all that, but with Concho, you know, he had a charisma about him. He knew how to speak to people, and he encouraged a lot of positivity in the dojo and just good energy. And, you know, people were hugging each other and it felt kind of like a church environment, which I guess is a little bit of foreshadowing. But, you know, we went to train as much to hear him talk to us as the actual training. You know, we were hanging on every word this guy would say. I mean, he was an amazing kind of orator. And he had a way of kind of hypnotizing you. He could speak to you about you. And it was something that I never found anything like that in any other Japanese dojo I went to.
Yeah, and you also touched in the book on, what was it, the great man theory, where in order to have these types of organizations or schools, you need a central figurehead that is as charismatic as you're talking about. But basically, the whole thing relies upon that image of him, or that ability of him to keep the whole thing together. You know, I think we saw in the karate world the same thing, where, you know, Robert Trias, who was the first guy to teach karate in the U.S., had the largest karate organization in the world. It was better. It was bigger. I would say better. Was that a Freudian slip? It was bigger than the JKF, the Japanese Karate Federation, at one point. But when he died, just everybody went every different direction. The people that were in his style split up into different directions. Some of them wound up coming back together. People that were in other styles started different groups. And there's just been nobody in the U.S. who can kind of keep everybody corralled like he could. And it sounds like your instructor was sort of similarly, I don't know, what's the word? Similarly charismatic, similarly mesmerizing, similarly unifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And we got a taste of that when he started leaving. And this is fast forwarding quite a bit, but, you know, our system, Seibukan Jiu-Jitsu, over the years, it became very large. I mean, we had, I think, over 20 schools maybe at one point, mainly in California, but we had some in Europe. We had some in Puerto Rico, Alaska.
That's huge.
I mean, we were big. And as a consequence of that, they all wanted Concho. They wanted him to come teach a seminar, promote students. And he started occupying a considerable amount of his time traveling literally around the world, plus going to Japan for kind of his own training. And what we started noticing was that when he wasn't in the headquarter dojo, which is where I trained in Monterey, it wasn't the same. Students stopped coming. And all that we were trying to do, the instructors, is we were trying to just mimic him.
Right.
But of course, a copy's never going to be as good as the real thing.
Right.
And it was a little depressing for all of us, realizing like, wow, this is the Julio Toribio show. And none of us are ever going to be able to keep this going without him. People are here for him. And we can lie to ourselves and say we're here for the training and we're here for the jiu-jitsu. But in this scenario, the martial art was just a pretense. We were there to listen to him and to experience the Seibukan philosophy.
Hey, everybody. Nate here. I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors, and they support us. Thanks, and you hit a beer. A lot of the things that you talked about in the book with some of these experiences, you know, some of them were what I would consider and what I've seen as very typical, you know, martial arts experiences. And then other ones, when they started to get out there, they were maybe amplified or intensified, where you might have, you know, you might have some of these stranger things that are going on, but some of the stuff is very basic, or I'm sorry, not very basic, very, very typical. So, you know, at the beginning of the book, I mean, you talked about this one incident where you're first starting and you're doing this sort of formal punching drill where you had to step back and punch the guy into the chin, and you know, you were kind of a little bit, you know, surprised or put back by that, you know, but on the other hand, that's a pretty typical way of practicing. And I thought, man, if this is the direction we're going, you know, this is going to be a long slog through this book if we're just going to pick apart training drills, because I think all of us can point to some training drill that's in some other style and say, yeah, look what they're doing. Look at this goofy thing. Therefore, everything that they're doing is bullshit, which I think is unfair. You know, but what were some of the things that you started seeing that really caught your attention as there's something unusual, or there's something not good, or not? I don't know if I want to use the word nefarious. You know, but what are some of the things that you started to see that made you question what you've been taught or what you've been working in the school?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the first part about the training, because for people that are listening that haven't read the book, you know, this is not a book about me training in martial arts and then discovering that my martial art wasn't effective and then I found a better one and now I'm happy. That is a part of the story, but the larger story is me, you know, joining a community that I thought was just the greatest thing that ever happened to me, and it consuming my identity and me becoming a complete servant of that community, to the point where arguably I was brainwashed, and definitely many people around me were, to the point where when there were serious abuses happening within our community, we didn't take the steps to make things right. And that's really what the story is about. You know, the fact that on, you know, my first night I hadn't learned how to punch someone quote unquote the right way, and I socked a black belt in the face by accident. that's kind of a funny story.
Right.
And also, you know, the fact that after I was a third degree black belt, I got my ass completely kicked by a dude that had been, you know, grappling for 6 months. Mm-hmm. That's a separate story.
Right.
But to get to what you were saying, Nate, some of the things that I started thinking about or noticing and thinking maybe this wasn't normal is that our intensity ratcheted up over this sort of 7-year period. Like I said, I joined at the right time when Seibukan was starting to explode. We were taking on more students, more uchideshi, which are like live-in students, that they sort of train full-time. And Seibukan had always had a philosophical component to it, which is pretty normal in martial arts.
Yeah.
But our philosophical component was getting really, really strong. Mm-hmm. To the point where we were required to know the Seibukan philosophy as much or more as we were required to know the technical aspect of the art. Mm-hmm. And we had to, you know, recite parts of it. And it was really deep, Nate. I mean, we had 21 concepts that we had to learn, and 7 gates, and we had 7 mystical animals, and all these different mottos and phrases, and all of this happened slowly. Like, if it would have been like that when I first stepped in the dojo in 2006, I would have been like, oh, this is a weird cult thing. I shouldn't be here.
Right.
But when it happens by degrees, you sort of don't realize it. And then you make excuses or justifications for it.
Right.
And then suddenly, you know, you're a black belt, you're a third degree black belt. Well, by that time you're invested. So the last thing you want to do is admit that you're part of something really strange.
Right.
So some of the things that were happening is one, we had a jargon that we used in Seibukan. It started with the fact that we spoke a lot of Japanese, or we used a lot of Japanese words and vocabulary. And again, you can attest to this. That's not unusual in Japanese martial arts.
No, it's just like, you know, if you're going to be playing baseball, if you're playing baseball in Japan, guess what? You know, it's swingu, strikeu, homoranu. And if you're doing Japanese martial arts in the U.S., you have to learn the terminology of what you're doing. So that could be, you know, uki or sekinzuki or kibidachi or ukemi or whatever it is. You're doing this thing, therefore you're going to learn the terminology for it. That is not unusual.
Yeah, totally. So then the next level that we went to was we started using it on and off the mats all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a small thing, but that made us a little bit less relatable to outsiders, right? To people that didn't train, because we were always sort of hanging out with each other and we would always use this language.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we had a lot of sort of keywords and buzzwords in Seibukan. We talked about the animals a lot. You know, we had the tiger and the dolphin and the bear and the owl and the wolf and the dragon. And I think I got everyone, the eagle. And we started talking about that. We started using these 21 concepts in sort of our everyday speak. And then Concho had a bunch of sort of mottos that he would say, and he would he had his five steps to be successful, and there were certain words he would never use. He would always substitute other words for him, and the philosophy was taking on a real self-help dimension, like kind of like a Tony Robbins.
Yeah,
you know, you can achieve your dreams, and there's a 7-step process, and we started really buying into that. And thinking that the Seibukan philosophy could change our lives and we could be super wealthy and marry a beautiful woman and drive a sports car. We just had to keep working the Seibukan philosophy.
Right.
And then we started trying to advertise that to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, you know, the joke about, hey, have you heard about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ?
Yeah.
I mean, we were going to outsiders and, you know, maybe people that had a pretty bad position in life. They were addicts of some sort. They had gone through a bad divorce, and we were going to them saying, "You got to come to our dojo.
Yeah.
This is going to change your life. I'm gonna introduce you to this man. He's gonna turn you around."
Yeah.
And suddenly, we were trying to convert people a little bit.
Right now, so I think that you know, with all the things that you brought up just now and in the book, there's sort of a line of where it's kind of normal and acceptable, and then, like you said, this transition happened in degrees, and at some point, and you're not exactly sure when, it sort of gets absurd. I mean, if you're talking about different slogans and sayings and things like that, I've got some that I use in class that I've gotten from different places, you know, my different teachers. You know, if I'm teaching a self-defense, I use alliteration. You know, you don't be in a stupid stance. You don't have helpless hands. Don't be at a dumb distance. Now, and so it's just sort of help people, you know, remember these things. And there's other little sayings and things and all the martial arts and little bits of advice. But when this, you know, in-depth philosophy starts getting added, and my assumption would be this was all from Concho. I don't think that there was any Japanese master that he's translating a book from that talks about the owl and the dolphin. My guess is this is all coming from him, and maybe he did listen to a Tony Robbins seminar, and that got incorporated into the overall philosophy.
Yes, it did all come from him, and that was another thing that sort of made it tricky, which is, you know, you have certain sayings or you know, mottos that you would use in training, and other of your peers might have those as well. But with us, it was all coming from one source.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were saying these sayings, I mean, we were always quoting our teacher.
Right.
And it got to a point where, you know, everything he would say, we would repeat, and we would do it in the way we would do it. I mean, you know, Concho's bald. People were shaving their heads, man. Like, you know, there was rituals that, and part of this was that we were in sort of a constant rat race for his approval and his attention and for him to notice us.
I mean, was it a brown nose competition to get the attention, or was it even that deliberate?
No, it was. It totally was. I mean, This was a guy that he had that X factor, and you wanted to be around him. You wanted him to notice you, mm-hmm. and certainly I did too. I was part of that rat race, and thank God I didn't get super deep in it.
Right.
But there was a group of students that it was a constant sort of invisible competition to get him to notice you and to spend time with you. I mean, this was a guy that it was really hard to get alone time with him. That was considered really valuable. Mm-hmm. And this leads into something I've went into in the book. And this is when things became to me a real problem, which is that, well, what's one way to get alone time with a master? Well, you could pay him for a private lesson.
Right. Yeah.
And then suddenly money became a vehicle to get time and attention from this man. And it wasn't that he was, telling everyone, hey, give me your money. Mm-hmm. But the point is that he didn't have to, right?
Yeah.
He knew that people wanted to be close to him and wanted to spend time with him. And I mean, for years, I took private lessons with him basically every single month.
Mm.
I'll tell you, you want to hear some crazy shit?
I want to hear the prices. And then I want to hear the crazy shit. Unless the prices are the crazy shit, then I'll hear them both at the same time.
Well, the prices aren't even, I mean, I gave tens of thousands of dollars to this organization over the years. And, that's not, I mean, martial arts costs money. Like that's, I understand that. That's commerce, right?
Yeah.
I pay a guy here in Southern California, every month to go to his school and train under him. And that's how it works. But, with Seibukan, I was paying for a private lesson every month, and that was, I think, $65 an hour,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't bad, actually.
That's not bad. That's not what I was
thinking. If you wanted to be – so have you ever been an Uchideshi, Nate?
No, I haven't. I honestly, until I got into your book, this isn't a term that, if I had heard it, I was like, what is it? Oh, yeah, I think I know what that is. But – it's not something that I've come across regularly in kind of wherever I've been. I mean, it's just not.
So an Uchideshi, for people that don't know, is it's like a live-in student.
Mm.
Then in the real hardcore traditional schools, they live in like the master's home or they live in the dojo. And it's a way to immerse yourself in the training.
Mm-hmm.
And we had that program in Seibukan. And it was seen as a way to train at the most intense level.
Right.
But really, it was sort of the VIP pass to get the most time and attention from Concho.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think a good price is for that?
Oh, man. Now, are utilities included? Do you get Wi-Fi?
We did house them. We did for several years have dormitories for them.
I tell you what, the places where I've stayed in a let me spit out a couple prices here. The prices that I've seen when I have stayed in dorms, there's a guy in Indiana who has a dorm with his dojo, but his dojo is in an old grade school, this enormous three-story, huge brick grade school from the turn of the century, and I think he is $20 a night at the Kodokan, the world headquarters for judo. I think it was like 1,800 yen, which is about $18 a night for the dorm, something like the equivalent of $25 a night for a private room. Was it? So I'm guessing you guys are paying more than that, though.
$500 a month.
Man.
And that is not including rent, my friend.
That's not the room and board. That's just to be
that's
in
the
program.
That's the price to be an Uchideshi.
Oh, man.
And oh, by the way, you have to pay your belt fees, of course. So when you get promoted, that'll be an additional fee. And oh, by the way, if you're an Uchideshi, you can get a black belt in 6 months. And then you can get your second degree 6 months later. And then you can get your third, fourth, fifth, all the way up to seventh degree every 6 months. And of course, there will be a nominal fee with each of those belts.
This is Mike Tarvin of Tarvin Plumbing Company. You may have heard me answering questions as a plumbing expert on the Gary Sullivan Show over the years. I'm here today to make you aware of our company. We perform plumbing repairs of all types. We've been in business since 1907, through five generations of family members. That's 109 years of providing top quality workmanship and outstanding service. If you're having issues with leaks, stoppages, water heaters, fixtures, or piping, we're here to help. Spring rains may be taking a toll on your sump pump. To help out, ask us about our summer sump pump special. We can inspect the existing pump and replace it if necessary for a special summer price. We can also inspect or add a battery backup and other devices for extra security to keep you high and dry. We offer you peace of mind for your plumbing system with reliable, trustworthy service backed by years of experience. Tarvin Plumbing is a Cincinnati company with an appreciation of the wide range of plumbing challenges this city offers. So if you or someone you know has a need for plumbing repairs of any type, please think of us at Tarvin Plumbing. You can reach us at tarvinplumbing.com. That's tarvinplumbing.com. Thank you.
Now, all the karate people right now are going nuts that are listening with these ranks. So we're going to come back to the ranks, but I had another question. So with Concho compared to you guys who were doing the training and were becoming, these zealots that are giving them all your money and doing all the training, how much of that was you guys sort of, fueling yourself, trying to one up one another, compared to him encouraging this actively or sort of subtly? What was the balance of that? I mean, where was the responsibility? I think it was on both sides. But can you break down? Can you separate that out a little bit?
Well, I think about that a lot because it's not always clear. It's a really blurry line. I mean, on the one hand, we were kids. Like, Sabukon was recruiting kids, young people in their teens, mm-hmm. 18 up to maybe like 25. Mm-hmm. And, we were hungry. We wanted purpose. This is part of the thing about true believers, Nate, is that they are a demographic, and you can identify who's likely to become a true believer based on a couple things. One is their age, and second is what's your position in society. Because a lot of us, like, we were feeling maybe a little bit lost in life, we were just out of school, kind of wandering around. Maybe we hadn't started college, or we weren't going to go to college. We were working kind of a shitty job, working at Johnny Rockets or whatever, mm-hmm. and dating a little bit, but we're certain, we're not getting married or anything.
Right.
And then suddenly this purpose comes along, and it's this incredible martial arts master, and he's saying, "Hey, come train with me. Yeah. Train personally with me. Be one of my uchideshi."
Yeah.
And it looks pretty attractive.
Yeah.
And of course, we would be willing to give him, this amount of money, and money that we didn't have, by the way. I mean, that's the real shame, is this money that we were spending was money that we were beg, borrowing, and stealing for. I mean, I knew a guy, he literally set his car on fire to get insurance money to pay fees. There were a group of us, and I was not one of them, so it's not us, but they joined a pyramid scheme. They were trying to sell me Alaskan fish oil so that they could, make money and try to, pay their belt fees or things like that.
Right.
And, Concho, like...
And it was... And these things, these sort of extreme things, they were to pay the martial arts fees, the belt fees, the promotion, the uchidashi fees. It wasn't because they were short on rent that month, or it was because they were short on rent because they were paying so much to the dojo. I mean, the fact that they were paying the school and the organization this fee is what put them in the situations to do these extreme things, right?
Yeah, and that was what really frustrated me, was that, I would talk to some of the true believers, and, one, they were really delusional about how much money they could make doing martial arts, and I think that Concho sort of was creating this false sense of confidence that a lot of them thought, all I need to do is just get my, my Menkyo Kaiden instructor certificate, and then I'm going to open a dojo, and my life is set. I'm going to make $1 million and yeah, I'm struggling right now and I don't have a lot of money, but like I'm working the Seibukon system and I'm using the principles. Mm-hmm. And I would always like, I'd want to shake him. I'd be like, you're poor because of Seibukon.
Right.
You know, imagine if you had $500 a month freed up. Yep. You know, like you could move into a better place. You could imagine if you didn't have to train 7 days a week, multiple classes a day. I mean, these kids, they couldn't take on real jobs because if you were an Uchideshi, you were required to train every night.
Yeah.
So, you know, what does that mean for where you're going to work? Well, you're going to get a shitty job. You're going to be making minimum, you know, wage. And with Concho, you know, he was encouraging students to do private lessons, to do Uchideshi.
Yeah.
And he would kind of frame it as like, hey, you know, if you're coming 2-3 nights a week, like, yeah, you're going to do all right. But if you really want to learn, you know, the secrets and train with me, then you should think about the Uchideshi program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was an adult. I mean, he was a grown man.
Right.
And part of me thinks that, you know, it would have taken a lot more courage, but I think he should have done it to take some of these kids aside and been like, hey, like, I care about you. Maybe you should train a little less.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you should give some attention to your family. Maybe you should get your finances in order. But no, for him, it was like, and for all of us, Seibukon was always the solution.
Mm-hmm.
It was always the thing that was going to deliver us from all of our problems. And we didn't really realize it was actually the source of a lot of our problems. It was the reason we were poor. It was the reason why we couldn't have functional relationships with other people because we couldn't stop talking about Seibukon and the system.
Mm-hmm.
It was the reason why we were, you know, living in shitty apartments and lighting our cars on fire.
Right. So I think anybody who gets into martial arts and really finds a connection to it is going to have that initial excitement. They are going to tell their friends and try to get them to join up with them or their family, even if the friends have no interest. Whatever you find, there's something new that you're going to tell. If you go see a movie that you really like, you're going to tell your buddy, "Hey, man, I really saw Black Panther, and I really dug it. You got to go check it out." I guess at a certain point, it just goes too far. And karate or martial arts in general can be good, and it can help people that are in a bad situation if they're bumming around and, you know, going out to drink one or two times a week too much. It's like, man, go to the dojo, get a workout in, you know, or go running, get a workout in, go lift some weights. So I think that, again, it's that line that I'm not sure how we pull it apart and separate it to, yes, there's a benefit, and yes, if you're genuinely excited about something, you're going to tell a bunch of people, to where it transitions from this is the answer of every problem in your life.
And I'll tell you a difference between some of the examples you gave. If I go see Black Panther and I think it's a great film and I tell you about it and you say, nah, you know, I don't think it's for me,
mm-hmm,
I would still be friends with you. But
with
Seibukon, it was sort of like we would move on to another prospect because it was, I mean, of course we never would think this way, but now that I can think about it objectively, mm-hmm, it wasn't about trying to help a friend. It was about recruitment.
Yeah. If you brought people in, was there a bump in the status or a bump to the access? You know, if you got the girlfriend to sign up, or you know, if you got the two homeless guys down the street to, you know, give Concho the panhandling money, you know, was that?
No, there wasn't any reward like that. I mean, if you were an instructor, of course you were always trying to, you know, sort of market and get people to join.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, at its most intense time, it was kind of like, well, if you don't do Seibukon, then it might be a little bit harder for me to relate to you because this is what I do. Like, it's my identity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I want you to join so that we have stuff to talk about.
Sure. Well, you know, and Seibukon is not alone in that. I mean, in karate, especially in the 70s, but we'll push that back into the 60s and then even into the 80s. And even now there's an attitude to different degrees, which was, I mean, the saying was this, you know, if you're not in karate, you're an asshole. If you are in karate, but you're not in my style, you're an asshole. If you're in my style, but you're not in my dojo, you're an asshole. If you're in my dojo, but you don't know go to the same classes as I do, you're an asshole. If you go to the same class as I do, but you're not me and you're not my instructor, you're an asshole, and I'm not even sure about my instructor. So it's very, very, there can be this very, very isolationist view, and I don't think you guys were alone in that.
I don't think we were, and that's why it's funny, some of the stuff you've mentioned, you've talked about a lot of the things that we did in extreme, you observe in moderation in the martial arts community in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why I think the book is important, because it doesn't take much to tip it from, oh, this is just normal, to, eh, maybe this is not quite normal, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that it would be good for people who, you know, if they're hearing this and one or two of the things that we've touched on, and there's a lot more in the book, but one of the things we've touched on, if you're seeing even a little glimmer of that, it's a good read, because as you're going through this, you're kind of going through a checklist in your own head. It's like, well, hey, man, I saw something kind of like this, or, you know, I visited this one school and they were kind of like that. And it kind of makes you just take a step back and analyze some of the things that you've done or seen. You know, I haven't seen anybody else, you know, do what you've done, which is, you know, put it all out there and put that very personal analysis out. And that took some guts, man.
Yeah, it was a scary thing to, I mean, once the writing was easy, and it was, of course, really cathartic, and it helped me go through sort of a healing process and confront some stuff that I probably would have not thought about for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I got to the 5-yard line, and it was like, okay, this thing's done, like someone's edited it.
Yeah.
Like, are you going to pull the trigger or not? And that was scary.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, Nate, for about the first month, I had someone that I trained with contact me every single day, a new person. And, you know, all of them read it fast.
Sure.
And none of them said, I think you're overreacting. None of them said, you said stuff that isn't true. You just got that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What they all said was, I'm so glad it wasn't just me, because I was thinking about a lot of this stuff too, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to be that guy that raises his hand and says, you know, hey, I have a problem with some of this, because then, of course, everyone descends on you and says, oh, you're overreacting. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's normal. It's healthy. And that's how we operated for a long time. I think that
we
all internally, something was off in our sort of moral compass or our internal compass.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's how a lot of these groups get a little out of control is, you know, it's scary to say something, and
nobody,
I'm not giving myself too much credit because I didn't say anything while I was in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to speak up once you leave. I had already left, and then I wrote the book knowing that the repercussions would be minimal. If I had more courage, I would have done it while I was in there.
Right. Nobody wants to be the guy who says the emperor has no clothes.
Mm.
You know, so looking back on it, so the thing that, you know, that Concho did very well is, I mean, he built this organization that I think a lot of martial arts people would be really jealous of. I mean, he's got these groups, he's making a living doing his martial art, doing his martial arts and teaching. I mean, it's doing a good job with PR. I researched, I watched a couple of videos of some of the promotions on TV, and they're edited together. Yeah, they're edited together real slick. There's one where, like, this, I don't think it was an eagle. It must have been the owl was flying in, and there's the music in the background, and it's
that was cut. Me. That was my video.
Oh, was it you? Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I made that. So.
Oh, you made that one? Yeah, it looks good. Did you make it recently, or was that when you were?
No, I made that. That was probably 2010 or 11. That was my Rokudon, my 6-degree black belt.
That's right. That was. But there was a couple others that were on there that were put together similarly, and maybe you made them. They were not – a couple of the other ones were not you. That one was – And, you know, it's great PR, where I think a lot of martial arts guys are, you know, some 60-year-old man that they can't really log onto his computer, and he's running some dojo. He doesn't take credit cards, and you know, give him cash, or they're teaching out of their home or the Y or something like that, where it's not very sophisticated. But Concho, I mean, even had the organization was set up so that if somebody wanted to go out and create their own dojo, he could almost franchise. I mean, he could probably give them a package and say, okay, this is what you need to do. This is how you sign them up. And so the business structure was good, but how much did that rely on some of the other weird stuff and the cultish stuff to fuel it? Do you think those two could be split apart, where you could have this sort of successful business operation, but not have to make a mecca to the Rock to meditate about it?
He totally could have. I mean, he didn't need to do this to be as successful as he was, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think that he didn't mean to. I mean, this is stuff that, just like it got out of control for me, I mean, I think it got out of control for him too. I think that, you know, I mean, imagine if you had dozens of people telling you how great you were all day, every day, all the time.
Yeah, man.
It might go to your head a little bit too.
Yeah.
But in terms of his sort of operation and the organization, it was well organized. There was continuity between schools, which is important in all martial arts, I think.
Yeah.
That every school was going to have the same uniforms. We were all going to wear the same logos. We were all going to have the same techniques, teach them the same way in the same order. Every instructor had to go and visit the headquarters in Monterey, where I was, mm-hmm. At least I think it was like once or twice a year, so that they could get the updates on the latest techniques.
Yeah.
And then from, you know, and this is maybe a little bit more the nefarious side of things, there was a constant effort to produce more instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was an effort to produce instructors regardless of whether or not they might've been ready.
Yeah.
You know, students that maybe they had just got their black belt, and, you know, to us, a black belt, you can get your black belt in 6 months if you're an Uchideshi.
Yeah.
You know, I got my first degree black belt in 9 months.
Jesus,
and
man.
And normally the minimum is a year. But I got
fast.
It 9 months because I took private lessons from Shihan instructors every single month. Plus, I came to every single class. So, you know, they kind of let me fast track because of that.
Right.
And actually, when I was a second degree black belt, you know, 1 year later,
right.
People, Concho asked me to open a school or to teach a school that was going to open in a nearby town. Wow. And, you know, I remember feeling really uncomfortable with that because even though I was a second degree black belt and mm-hmm. people that don't do martial arts, that might seem really impressive to them. You know, one, in Japanese martial art, there are a lot of different black belt levels. So mm-hmm. a first degree black belt, it doesn't mean that you've developed mastery in most systems.
Oh, sorry, folks. We didn't quite make it to the rank discussion. But Louis and I had a really interesting conversation that wound up going a little bit longer than we both anticipated. So he'll be back on the show next week, and we'll get into the belts at the top of the show. Thanks again to Louis Martin, author of The True Believers, for joining us this week. You can find the book, The True Believers, on Amazon, and I have added the link to the show notes on Facebook. Thanks for listening. Nihei Biru and Mataya. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks. Chop Talk is brought to you by the Kosho School of Karate's premium martial arts training equipment. Frustrated with the low quality of the big manufacturers, the hassle and expense of custom-made equipment, or the months-long delivery times offered by the Japanese brands, if your order ever arrives at all? Kosho offers Makiwara, iron sandals, specialty punching bags, and other premium martial arts training equipment, all at great prices and great delivery times. Kosho equipment is guaranteed to be high quality and heavy duty, exactly what serious traditional martial artists demand. Contact the Kosho School of Karate for more information. Go to www.koshoequip.com or email koshoschoolofkarate@gmail.com. Kosho, premium martial arts training equipment for the serious martial artist.